Blog Talk Radio. Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, LA poet, musician, and performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, my guest is LA writer Steve Abey. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing well, Rich, man.
Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, dude. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Steve Abey was born in Santa Monica, California, and began writing right after high school when he held a job as an orderly at St. John's Hospital. He's the author of the recently released novel Johnny Future on MP Publishing, which is distributed through PGW. He's also the author of the poetry collection Great Balls of Flowers with Right Bloody Books. He's also authored The Bus, Cosmic Ejaculations of the Daily Mind in Transit on Phony Lid Books, and the unfortunately now out of print collection of short stories and poems, King Planet on Incommunicado. That was actually a press that I really loved. Beck has praised Steve Abey as the love-powered bullhorn blasting down from the altitudes. Jerry Stahl calls Abey's work a naked celebration of love for the damaged and damaged love. All this, and Steve Abey still somehow manages to maintain a family and teach for the Los Angeles Unified School District. Well done, Steve.
Oh, thank you, man. That's, yeah, it's a lot of stuff when you say it like that.
I know. It's funny listening to one's own bio or resume at times, and yes, you've a great number of accomplishments you've achieved. Steve, it's been a while since I've read your latest novel, Johnny Future. You sent me a draft of it a while back just before it was ready to go off to printing. Here are some thoughts that I recently found that I had jotted down after reading it. From high atop the hills of El Segundo to the low-down, dirty boulevards of Hollywood, Johnny Future reigns supreme as the protector of the old, the disenchanted and disenfranchised. He is so aptly named because his heart is as huge and wide open as the future itself. Yet not only is he of the future, but of the now and always, a timeless dreamer, a wounded saint of the streets. Steve, can you start by telling the listeners a little about the book?
Oh, well, yeah, man, you said a lot there. I mean, that's Johnny Future, you know. He's a wounded saint of the streets. Is that what you called him?
Yes.
Dude, that's beautiful. yeah, I mean, you know, he's a messed up guy who's, you know, trying to make some sense out of his own life in his own, you know, weird way. Goes on a wild goose chase. Well, he has a vision, and, you know, the vision is that he needs to save his grandmother from dying alone in a old folks' nursing assisted living care, assisted living place, and you know, goes and busts her out while, you know, he's, you know, kind of in this delusion, you know, fueled by some copious amounts of drugs and bad living, and you know, kind of comes to some redemptive realizations also about his, you know, about his fucked upness, and about, you know, he was doing something for somebody, you know. So
yeah.
All this running we do is nothing but love.
Well said. How was Johnny Future born, and how did his voice come to you?
Well, you know, Future was born out of some, you know, times when I was, you know, myself kind of struggling with stuff, and, you know, I don't know, doing a lot of chemicals, and it's just this mind idea. Where else did they come from? But this, you know, this picture of a character that you know, I mean, it wasn't always like, you know, it was just kind of running on empty, you know, looking for some truth, and it was just kind of born out of that, you know.
Yeah.
Just kind of born out of that, you know.
You know,
different brokenness.
Yeah. In reading Johnny Future, it was obvious for me to see that it has a very poetic soul. Still, it's a work of fiction. I'm curious, how easy is it for you to shift back and forth between your poetry and fiction?
Oh, well, it's not easy at all. It's hard. I mean, fiction's really difficult because, you know, just trying to make all these, you know, I mean, really like cinematic decisions, you know, plot decisions, where characters go and things like that. You know, poetry is just, you know, born of the moment. And for me, you know, there's just that kind of expansive, the expansive explosion of language, with, you know, which is like the bus, you know, which is grounded in moment and place, but, you know, doesn't really require one to like create fictional directions. So, you know, fiction's a challenge, man. It was, you know, just like, does he go left? Does he go right? You know, and also wanting to infuse it with that, you know, language, his own language. I mean, that was kind of the thing. It was like the character was born out of these riffs that would just come, you know, while just like, you know, kind of tripping on rooftops, you know, watching sunrises after sunrises, and you know, just kind of like meshing with the language of everything, and just that's where the character, you know, came from. So, you know, kind of honoring that and just letting that, you know, fuel it, and just, you know, just kind of taking it to the places where, you know, from inspiration, you know, the Kerouacs and the Beat Daddies and the, you know, Walt Whitmans and Henry Millers. I mean, all these people who I have, you know, really vibed with, and, you know, just trying to create like a, you know, a mind of search, you know, within the city, a kid, a guy, young man, you know, turning 30. Who's you know, just looking, you know, for the soul of stuff.
Right. Well, you mentioned the language before, and that was actually one of the things that struck me about Johnny Future, is how he was able to express sometimes the simplest of moments in, you know, this pure poetry. And I couldn't help but to think again and again that in the hands of a less skilled writer, that this could have come off as a disaster, just trying to talk about these simple moments of life and for it not to sound mundane. How are you able to pull that off?
Well, thanks for the compliment, man. I mean, you know, I appreciate the, you know, like it's, you know, you just, I appreciate the fact that you think it was achieved, you know, to answer the question, I mean, you know, one of the things when you write in kind of lyrical prose is one can drift too far into the image and lose the ground. So I was trying to be conscious of, you know, not losing the ground, you know, which is, you know, what's happening, where he's going, and kind of this, you know, narrative moment, physical narrative moment. And then, you know, but at the same time, you know, infuse his words with, you know, kind of epiphany. I wanted to make it into an adjective. I don't have the tongue for it right now. But you know, just infuse them with epiphany, you know, which is the, you know, that's the cataract of prose, just the stuff that, you know, kind of just describing the, you know, the wildness of mind, the Will Alexander cascade of pure poetry. But you know, trying to tell a story like that is challenging because it's just like, what the fuck is going on? And then you know, so he's just bringing it back down to, like, you know, where he's at and where he's going and what he wants and what he needs. I mean, you know, the first, I don't know, section of the book is really a story about, like, a guy going nowhere, doing nothing.
Right.
You know, which is a challenge, you know.
It's just, yes. You know, were you, I know you received your MFA from Antioch. Were you in the Antioch program when you began writing Johnny Future, or were you writing Johnny Future before the program? Or
I was writing Johnny Future before the program, but did a lot of significant work on it in the program. I mean, really kind of created, you know, the if you know, I guess the like the first two, you know, 2/3 of the novel while in the program. And you know, it was a good program for that because they don't have any specific bent that they're trying to promote, so they're just kind of open to the work that you were working, you know, that you're working on. And Dodie Bellamy, well, Jane DeLynn was the you know, first teacher that I really got serious with. And I wrote it like a, I don't know, about a third of it with this one guy that I first worked with, and then I didn't like that. And then I got serious with this woman named Jane DeLynn the second semester I was there, and that was awesome. And then I, you know, finished another third of it with this woman named Dodie Bellamy. And, you know, it's just kind of like being able to be lyrical but holding on to this, you know, kind of a tight sense of narrative. You know, I mean, honestly, it's like, you know, yeah, so I did a lot of work for it from, you know, on it there.
Yeah, and how did MP Publishing, how did it get to MP Publishing?
Well, you know, the thing is, after I got out of Antioch, it was like, I was kind of bummed out, you know. I mean, I don't know, I had a falling out with the last teacher I was working with there, and, you know, I wasn't really sure, like, what direction to take the novel, because, you know, the second third ends on this total epiphany, which is, you know, probably the part I'm going to read, and it's like, where do you go from here? And it's like, you know, and it's just, so there was a lot of issues. And then I read it about a year after I got out of Antioch at Echo Park Film Center, and people were just totally into it. So I started working on it again, and this guy, Timothy Wager, decided he wanted to represent it. So they sent it out, and nobody picked it up except for McAdam Cage, and they kind of goofed around with it while they were having their own internal trouble, and then they finally dropped it after they goofed around with it for about a year and a half. And then about a year later, the editor from McAdam Cage had gotten the job as editor-in-chief at MP Publishing, and he asked if I still had the novel available, and I said yes, and then they put it out.
Well done. Well done. Why don't you go ahead and read us something from Johnny Fletcher?
All right, well, yeah, I'm, you know, I'll read a section where he is he's at this party at his friend Charlie Gahn's house, and he is just come out of the bathroom where he had a vision, and now he's going to go outside and get direction, so to speak. All right, we're all part of the water, man. The water's all over the place. We're all water, man. We're all part of each other's water. We got each other's water all over us, stuck to our shoes, up in our hair. Every time I take a drink of you and you and you. And every time I pee, you come out of me, all of you. The earth is spoken. I got to get my piss straight. That means love, love, and more love. I point to each one of them with my cigarette. America's into it. That's cool. She's smiling and shaking her hair at me. Charlie's talking to himself. That's cool. Willie the bag's heading for the back door. That's cool, too. It's all cool in this sad, wet world. The drugs are rioting in my blood, turning over buses, shooting down planes. Yeah, man, on the floor, the pee of life, you and me, everywhere. I got to get straight and do my thing. Baby Juice is checking me out hard, really into it with me all the way. She knows what I'm talking about. She's small, she's mild, she's mad. She's a little drop of water on the curb, ready to be absorbed, to fall into a pour, become all of us. I can see it in her. I can see it in America's green eyes and big blonde hair. I can see it in everyone, all of them, standing there. It's in her and in Charlie's sweaty, trouble-lined face, on everything. The dishes in the sink, the ants in the garbage, the window broken, Junior's bald head. Oh, yeah, it's in Junior's bald head. Charlie smiles at me and winks. He leans over to Junior all close like he's going to kiss him and ask him to lay out another round of bumps. Junior pushes Charlie away and crushes up some more, and we do the deal all over again. I do my portion and don't feel like saying shit. I feel like I'm Kitty Young being stuffed by the huge wiener of love and hate. I'm being split wide open and showers of white light are falling down on me. Is this what it's like to be a porno star? Is this what it's like to give it up for all to see? It's cool. Let them all see. I didn't get laid, but I got white light coming down on my brain, going up my ass, making me dizzy. I go outside, get some air, stumble and float through the backyard to the fence, kick the spray can paint cans out of the way and pull up a chair so I can watch the freeway and the city and the world. I smoke a cigarette and wish I had a drink. I'm feeling all the chemicals in my body. Jesus is back here singing. I don't listen. I got other things on my mind, big things sitting there like stones, like missiles right on my mind, big-ass Easter Island stone-faced missiles in my head. The shit don't let up. I got it all over me tonight. Somebody save me. I don't know what else, what these things are. They won't show me their face. I think it's Dolly. She's the big Easter Island stone face missile. I got to go and get her to save her, my grandma Dolly. I hear a ruckus in the house. It's Baby Juice and Casper again. I think Casper got it on with Cody, too, when little Fishy was into it. She was standing back there checking it out, kind of like waiting her turn in the train. I can hear Baby Juice screaming and Casper saying, "What the fuck? What the fuck?" That's all cool right now because I'm seeing a little kid on the freeway for real. Right now, under the leaves of the trees and the stars in the sky, there's a kid running around on the freeway. I get up and go to the fence. I'm freaking out. The kid's maybe 7, maybe 9, running around in circles, yelling, I don't know what. A car comes. It's going to hit him. It doesn't. It misses him. I can hear what he's saying. He's screaming, "Hey, Kool-Aid, what the fuck is that? Get the fuck off the freeway. You're going to get killed, you fucking idiot." I yell loud, shaking the fence. He keeps running and screaming about Kool-Aid. "You can get Kool-Aid. You can't get Kool-Aid on the freeway, kid." He doesn't hear me. I pull myself over the fence. "You fucking can't get any Kool-Aid on the freeway, you little dickhead." I'm real concerned about this kid and his Kool-Aid. It's freaking me out. He's running around out there, and the cars go by, and they don't even honk. It's like nobody sees him but me. How'd he get out there? Where are his parents? He's a stupid kid that doesn't know what he's doing, and he needs to get off the fucking freeway and go somewhere else to look for Kool-Aid, someplace where they actually sell the stuff. I run down the hill to the freeway, ripping through the ivy. I can't see my shoes. I trip on a sprinkler pipe, fall down, hit my head on a beer can buried in the weeds, get up, see the kid still running around, yelling. I wipe the sticks and dead leaves and other crud off my pants and jacket. I'm on the side of the freeway next to the call box. Cars rushing by, raging steel boxes of mad wind. Man, they won't stop, ever. It's getting later, and the freeway's growing more and more cars every second. The kid's yelling, "Kool-Aid," and no one's stopping. No one sees him. I know what's happening. I know why he's yelling for Kool-Aid on the freeway. No one's stopping and no one sees him. He's yelling Kool-Aid because there ain't no Kool-Aid and he needs some. The kid needs me, man. The kid is me, man. That's me yelling for Kool-Aid, man. Life, man. Yelling for life. I see Dolly on a Toyota rooftop. It's a long time ago in the backyard of her house. She's drinking a Pepsi, crying on the lawn chair, thinking about my mom, her daughter, who just killed herself. Dolly's cat's come up to her hand and rubs its nose on her fingers. I'm high. I'm so fucking high and fucking sad right now, seeing my grandma on top of that car. That is some sad shit, man. Sadness just ripping me up and down, laughing at me. This is freaking me out. I want to take my arms off and legs off and everything. Just take it off. Let the strings go, man, and just flop down through the ground into the center of the earth, down to the molten eyeball of everything. The little kid's running around in circles. Boom, he gets nailed by a car. Oh, no. Oh, shit. I freak out. He flies up. The dark sky holds him. He falls back down on the freeway. I can't take it. That's it. I got to take my clothes off and save the little kid. That's all there is to it. I got to be butt naked, pure for the starlight, for the kid. I take off my clothes. I get naked. I'm naked. I got nothing on. My dick is bobbing around all cold and vulnerable, innocent in the car's lights, because I'm jumping up and down, yelling at the cars from the side of the freeway. There's a rock in my foot, a little one. It doesn't hurt. The cars are honking at me. I throw my arms into the air. I'm flapping around. I'm a lost dog. I'm a butterfly. I'm an empty can. I run into the traffic and stub my toe on those reflector things. I'm going to save the kid. Two cars honk right by me. I can feel the wind on my ass cheeks. I don't give a fuck. Stop! Stop! You're running over the kid, you assholes! I scream. Car screeches by, another honks, just misses me. The air goes whoosh right up my butt and around my balls. The horn goes wah off somewhere else and disappears. Fucking stop, I scream at them, trying to find the kid. Where's the fucking kid? Where the fuck are you, kid? There's no Kool-Aid. There's no kid. Just me. I'm the only one out here. I'm the Kool-Aid. A bright yellow truck honks, just misses me. It's the Western Exterminator. The death truck, little man, looks me right in the eye with the sunglasses of death, wagging his finger, holding his mallet. Mr. Bug Death is fucking with me directly. I got your mother. I won your happiness. I got it, crushed it, and threw it away. I'm going to get you and your grandma, too. I win. I always win. I always win. Fuck you, Mr. Bugdead. Fuck you. You're not going to get me. You're never going to get me. Or Dolly, motherfucker. My toe is bleeding. I run back to the side of the road, to the call box. I don't call anyone. The cops are coming. I can feel it. I grab my clothes, slip my shoes on, and run naked up the ivy hills to the fence. Everyone's there. The whole party's looking at me like I don't know what. I climb the fence, yelling, and fall into Charlie's backyard with a thud. Jesus starts singing. Naked, crazy-ass white man on the freeway. How come? Don't know. Thought he was going to die. Naked-ass Johnny Future on the freeway. Thought he was going to die. I'm right here on the ground, naked in the dirt, looking up at the sky, at the three stars, at Charlie and everyone, America, Cody the slut, Baby Juice, everyone standing around looking down on me. I am the champion freeway knight of love, and I have to save my grandma right now. The sirens come, the helicopters too, but I am under the invisible tree in Charlie Gunn's backyard. America bends down real close, her hair like light all around, and pulls a piece of tape off my eyebrow.
Beautiful, Steve. And that was from Johnny Future out on MP Publishing, distributed by PGW. Steve, as you were reading, and also when I was going through the novel, you know, how, I mean, because before you were talking about poetry being of the moment, fiction, you have to deal with, you know, elements of plot decision and the like. You know, and as I mentioned before, too, you know, the way Johnny Future speaks, it's, you know, a lot of it is very much in the moment. So you do have that poetry fused throughout the book. And there's a lot of velocity to that voice, to that poetry. How difficult was it for you to maintain his voice, to maintain that kind of velocity throughout the novel?
Well, I think it's totally different. I mean, yeah, I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say it was 11. You know, I mean, that's a challenge of, like, trying to create this character whose mind is unraveling, and it's in the first-person present tense. You know, there's no perspective. You know, because when you read fiction, narrative, you know, you want to, there's a cushion sometimes that the reader wants to have. And, you know, so being able to, like, you know, move story along and at the same time have, like, expansive derangement, delusion, you know, the cascade of language, it's difficult.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the degree that the novel doesn't work, it's probably because of that difficulty. I mean, also, I guess, I don't know, maybe I could have made some plot decisions here and there that were different, yada, yada. But the degree that it does work, you know, is, I mean, that's what I want to do. I wanted to give a voice to this kind of mind.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
And,
you know, in a poem of yours, 3 a.m. in New Mexico, 1996, which is in Great Balls of Flowers, which we'll talk about in a moment, there's a line in that particular poem where you say, Johnny Future talks in my head, will I ever like him? What were some of the struggles when you wrote that? What were some of the struggles you were dealing with?
Well, he's a fucked up guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. He's a fucked up guy, and, you know, he's like, I mean, you know, you don't want that guy, like, I don't know, taking care of your kids.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the thing about, like, you know, fiction is it requires this consuming involvement, and it's like, I mean, you know, you got to sit there and give voice to, you know, these people that come to you and try to be, you know, honor it and be legitimate with it, and, you know, at the same time, you might not, you know, dig them all the way, or like, you know, what you're searching in them is like some kind of darkness in you. I mean, obviously,
absolutely,
the character came out of my own experiences, and, you know, and you know, it's also like, you know, I had this one guy criticized the book, saying like, there's all this stuff that I'm getting out of it, but Johnny Future's not saying that. I'm like, dude, that's called interpretation. You're getting it because that's like, you know, it's like, anyway, it was this weirdest review. It was like he got all this message and understanding, but he criticized the fact that Johnny Future wasn't like narrating that specific interpretation. I'm like, that's
right.
What fiction's all about. You know, it was weird. It was a trip. But the thing is, you know, so I'm like, he's a limited, you know, unreliable narrator, I believe is the theoretical term.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, that's it's a challenge, yeah, super challenge.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the problem I got myself into. I just wanted to see it through, and it took a bajillion years, and I was, you know, fortunate to get it published.
Yeah, well,
but,
well done for completing it, and well done for getting it published, man.
Yeah, and it, you know, it got the worst review ever.
Oh, really?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know if I should say that. I'm kind of proud of that in a way, but like. You know, when it was going to come out with McAdam Cage, I think they sent it out a little early. Like, it should, you know, it could have, like, gone through some more editing. And I'm not, anyway, there were some issues with, I'm not sure that it was, I don't know. right. some issues with who was really understanding it. But, dude, Publishers Weekly just freaking gave me a Kilgore Trout, you know, working over.
Oh, man. Well, let's move on.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all.
Did you get some good? Well, I would imagine you got some good reviews too, though, right?
Yeah. No, people were into it. You know,
yeah.
People were into it. Nobody like. You know, I didn't get any like Salon.com just blowing away. I mean, I don't even. You know, it's just kind of like. It's just an underground trip.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to get. It's hard to. You know, it's uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable book.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not a comfortable book. I will totally agree with that. And
cleans his grandmother's shit, you know.
After, yeah.
Anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And we move at Johnny Future's pace, whether it's moving
yeah.
at light speed or just like so into the minutia of the moment. You know, we have to
yeah.
go at his pace, man. And he takes us to some. Beautiful places, and he takes us to some dark places. So it's just like
yeah.
along for the ride.
Yeah.
I want to, before we run out of time, I want to move on to Great Balls of Flowers for a little while.
Sure.
Your poetry collection on Right Bloody. You know, there are a number of poems in the collection, and you know, I've known you for a number of years and have seen you
yeah.
reading live, and you know, have read King Planet, And what kind of struck me about Great Balls of Flowers, you know, there are a number of poems in the collection, for example, Pissed Off at Nothing Again, that possess a really beautiful confessional tone. And I think it sort of surprised me at first, because I think it was one of the first times I'd sort of seen this more vulnerable side of you, this more open, personal side of you. And I also noticed that you mentioned Ted Berrigan a couple few times in the collection, and you know, a bit of his poetry is that way too, very open and revealing. And I'm wondering, were you at all inspired by Ted in this style of writing when writing some of the poems in Great Balls of Flowers, or what is that connection for you with him?
Oh yeah, man, absolutely. You know, it was a really like, you know, it was a lesson when I was reading, you know. Once again, at the Antioch MFA, I was working with David Trinidad at the time, and he was, you know, suggesting some poets to read, and, you know, I'd heard of Ted Berrigan, but hadn't really, you know, sat down with his work in that way you do when you're, you know, at school. But, you know, being in Antioch, it was not like a high-pressure, you know, criticize the stuff. It was just like, you know, read it and be with it. And, you know, man, I was reading Personal Poem Number 9, and, you know, the idea was, like, kind of just be inspired by this, just, you know, write, like, Ron Padgett, Ted Berrigan, just write a poem, just write, you know, this kind of spontaneity. And this crazy thing, man, the day that I was writing it was the same exact date on the poem. I believe it was, like, July something or other. You know, it's just really one of those, you know, weird, like, connection moments. So I'm just like,
right.
This is interesting. But he was totally inspirational, because it was this, yeah, there's this really open confessional tone. I was, you know, I just finished The Bus, you know, which is, which is confessional, but in a different way. It's got a lot more of the, you know, the high velocity.
Yes.
You know, confession. And, you know, I was reading Berrigan. I had actually gotten sober, was sober a couple of years at that point. And I don't know, it was, I mean, I know he wasn't a sober cat, but by any means, but his openness, just the open spirit of his line.
Yes.
Is beautiful. And, you know, and the fact that it's deeply informed, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
It's deeply informed poetry.
I commend you for that, you know, because I'm used to the sort of high velocity, gritty gasoline, you know, a little bit of beat from time to time, Steve Abey. And so to read these other poems that, you know, which were, you know, a little more personal, sort of stripped away of some of those other elements, I was just like, wow, way to go, Steve, you know, because, you know, it's a brave move, you know, when someone just is that revealing, sort of strips away.
Yeah.
Some of that writer voice to just kind of review the to sort of reveal the humanity. We're getting close to the end of our time, but I do not want our time to end without you reading something from Great Balls of Flower. So I was wondering if you could maybe choose 2 or 3 minutes from either Sucks, a couple of my favorite poems, Sucks, or You Must Love This, and I'll let you choose.
Okay. I mean, you know, it's funny because the asshole poem is kind of really in the spirit.
Well, actually, I've got that. I've got that one written down too. So why don't you go for that one?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, the other ones are awesome. I mean, you know, You Must Love This is definitely a chant, very much in the in a beat spirit. I mean, so but the asshole poem is you know, these poems were called personal poems. You know, I was going to make a collection called Personal Poems based off of Frank O'Hara and Ted Berrigan's, you know, titling,
right.
You know, my own version. And so the asshole poem is one of the personal poems. July 31st. Yeah. See, and it's all about centering with time and place. So here we go. It's July 31st. It's after 11 p.m. Just. I'm in Berkeley, California, slightly obsessed with Ted Berrigan, his wife, the only female poet I'm enthusiastic about. That's bad. I know. I should be enthusiastic about Louise Gluck, Adrienne Rich, but Alice Notley moves me. She's secret. We are about honesty here, filling the page with fingerprint words. In the car right now, I was brilliant. Words and lines like meditations, presence, vision, hanging from my eyes and the bodies and the lights and the shadows of Shattuck Avenue. Now I can't remember a thing. What I want to say honestly with poetry, vision, inspiration, and art sputtering all around me like sand crabs digging holes in the newly gone tide is that I am an asshole. And I'm sorry for snapping at my wife today in San Francisco on the J train. I had a good day today with the family in San Francisco, saw the Chagall retrospective, and saw a show, a retrospective of a man named Philip Guston, a discovery for me like discovering sunlight. Chagall was cool, lovely, Chagall, of course, but Guston was there. I mean, the man was present in his work. I mean, his spirit, his ghost was there. Angel of paintbrush vapor, essence of rust nail, cigar smoke, crucifixion halo. What mossy headdress did yon apparition wear? He was there directing us all to the pain and moment in each canvas. Chagall, I think, has returned to life as a cat or a verse of poetry. But Guston was there, weeping on the floor, joy tears, blood water. I was breathing out palms when I was walking through his canvases. Okay, need a new word for spirit, one not bleached by the new age. One that speaks of the invisible present presence of holy anger and love, bodies breaking open and the fruit, open the fruit within, personal trees between us all. What is that? The point is, the day was good, but I was just an asshole for about 3 minutes. A minute, 90 seconds, and that really fucks with the other 1,437. I'm not trying to be funny here, I'm just trying to get up and upfront about everything. I told my wife she was retarded. She looked retarded on the F train, carrying the kids' bottles of Gatorade in her purse. We all got on the crowded F in San Francisco, the driver saying kindly, the kids are only 35 cents, and me not having 35 cents, just dollars. Kathy, do we have 35 cents? She digs through her purse. It was so sad watching her dig through her purse. What is it about her purse? Her and her purse. Why is it so sad? Her digging through her purse. I was whacked out on Ghirardelli's chocolate sundae, and she was the universe searching for itself inside a dark, a Q-tip market receipt-filled purse in San Francisco. The noise, the people, no seats, Maya sitting on the floor, tired legs, defenseless tourist in the city, and she, so humble and earnest, looking for 35 cents, and me, waiting, with all the sadness. Sorrow is always the body beneath anger's horrible face. Why so sad? Why angry at sadness? She found it, but I was already heartbroken. I couldn't just fall apart there, no. So I got mean and said bitterly with poison, trying to mask the heartbreak of her pureness, of the world's silliness, the cruelty of 35 cents, a great day with the family. Really, no shit, no irony, a great day. But it's cruel just the same, because they end like everything, and you want to pound the floor. Stay, no, stay. And I looked at the Gatorade sticking out of her purse, ridiculous and awkward paraphernalia of motherhood, children's drinks, bought because the kids cry and whine, and it's not the worst thing they could want, but of course they only drink a mouthful, and then you are carrying them in your purse or jacket pocket, a smart-looking bag meant for discreet items, keys, a compact, a hidden mess perhaps, but not the tops of Gatorade bottles, lemon, lime, and fruit punch flavor. No, that is too naked, too on the run. I can't live like that, not with eternity coming down all around us, the German tourists and the train man watching down here at Fisherman's Wharf. I'm tired, tired of myself. Tired of my attempts to make art out of neurosis, rage, addiction, disease. But my throat is twinkling. Little men inside me are laughing. I am funny to them. Who are they? I think they are responsible, and I am sorry for saying you really look retarded. Here, let me take those and put them in my bag. I hide them in my newly purchased City Lights 50th anniversary book bag, which marks me as a different kind of tourist. My wife looks at me. She wants to cry. She is vulnerable. She is as open-hearted as the sky. She wants to kill me, too, of course, like life. Love is so thin and fragile, like breath, and just as enduring. She just stands there and says nothing, looks at me. What? It's true. Let me take those. They look retarded. Someone on the trolley stinks of alcohol. The driver, I think. His copy of the New Testament propped up in the window. His kindness, frantic, pleading. Please, please, step up the stairs. We can count the money on the trolley.
Beautiful, Steve.
Thanks, man.
That was the asshole poem from Steve's collection, Great Balls of Flowers, out on Right Bloody Books. Hey, Steve, we're at the end of our time. Where can people find you online? Where can people find your books?
Well, you know, I don't have a website proper. I have a Facebook, you know. People want information. You know, you can get the books at Skylight Books, though. Skylightbooks.com, they you know, carry everything I've done. I mean, Amazon, too, of course. You know, Skylight Books, if you're in Los Angeles, you can head over to Skylight. They've got they got stuff. Though I haven't been over there to check and see exactly how much they have, but
right.
They carry my business. You know.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Steve. It's been a real pleasure and honor.
Hey, man. I appreciate it. Really do.
Yeah. I want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. I want to send also a big thank you out to Julia for helping to produce the show today. The show's theme music is by We Voice Sing. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook. Next week, my guest will be writer, educator, and dancer, Gail Brandeis, and she does so much more as well. I'm very excited about that show. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.